Will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Our speaker is being recorded tonight with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren, back there. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Guy from San Clemente.
My name is Guy. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 16th, 2002, and I want to thank Martian for asking me to speak here. It's an honor and privilege to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And you know, before I start, really, I want to, you know, mention my friends that are here tonight. I mean, you're all my friends, but like special people that came, like Oscar and his wife Carissa came, and Greg and Andrea and Reg from LA. See, this is a good story. I'll tell you this real quick. Reg and I are old friends. We met in recovery, and I hadn't seen her in like seven years. She moved to LA, and I think we reconnected at Christmas, and we texted a little bit. And out of the blue, I get a call from her today, and she says, "I'm coming down to South County. Is that meeting still going on at Aragon?" And I'm like, yeah, I'm speaking tonight, you know, right? Now, come on, if you believe in, you know, that's a God thing, right? I mean, you know, you just can't believe in coincidences. But good, a second water. But you know what? I want to say something real quick. There was a lot of talk about the coffee and stuff. When I first got sober and all through my sobriety, this guy kept the coffee commitment here for years. Do you guys remember Paulie? Yeah. Everybody remembers Paulie. Well, yeah, Paulie passed away Monday. Okay, so, and Marcia thought we'd have a moment of silence for Paulie, if you all knew Paulie. All right, thanks, Paulie. But you know, those commitments are so important, they're just so huge. You know what? I'm an alcoholic, okay? I'm an alcoholic like the big book talks about. And I have no reservations that that's the kind of alcoholic I am. But I also, alcohol wasn't the only thing I did to change my head, right? I like to do, just you name it, everything. So I'm going to be talking about that a little bit tonight, you know? It's like, I mean, alcohol is a stone killer. It'll kill you faster than anything. But when all I was doing was drinking, man, it was like I was on a health kick. Yeah. Drinking was like chamomile tea at one point. But you know, I started in the beginning. I came from a family of alcoholics. My dad was an alcoholic, right? So I saw that from a young age. Okay, he was a violent alcoholic. When I walked in the door, or when he walked in the door, I never knew what to expect. Either he was going to be like this kind, loving, happy drunk, or he was just going to knock me across the room, right? That was something as a child I learned to deal with. So I saw alcoholism at a very young age. And my mother, the same thing. She didn't drink. She was like, she should have probably got some Al-Anon. But that's how I was raised with that. So I was exposed to alcoholism at a very young age. And you know, I'm going to skip ahead. Well, the one thing I want to say is I'm not a victim, okay? I don't consider my alcoholism as a result of my upbringing, okay? I don't buy into that whole thing, right? I'm more like I inherited this, because I can tell you what, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to my first drink when I was like 14 or so. The first time I tasted alcohol, we did like what most kids do. We stole some booze from one of the kids' parents, and we passed this bottle around. And this first drink of this stuff, right, tasted horrible. It was some kind of, I'll never forget, evergreen gin or something. Or maybe gin tastes like evergreen. But I know I ended up in the bushes, evergreen bushes, before the night was over. But that first taste of alcohol was so wonderful, man, the way it made me feel. Okay, it was like the world was in black and white, and all of a sudden it was in color, okay? I mean, it worked for me. It just changed how I saw things. And I think I was alcoholic from the first thing, and I was just wanting more, more, more. And I drank to, you know, where I had the spins, the whole nine bit, and they carried me home and knocked on the door and just ran off. And my parents are having a party at the point, at the time, right? So my parents bring me in. I'm so drunk. I'm so drunk I can't even see. I lay on the couch, and I'm laying on the couch, and they're downstairs. This is in outside Detroit. They have basements there. And I'm laying on the couch, and I'm like getting the spins, and I'm just thinking, man, I can't throw up. If my mom finds out how drunk I am, I'm going to be in big trouble. So I'm laying there, and I put my hand over my mouth. And I could feel it, this intense, it was coming, man. And I was laying on my back with my hand on my mouth. And when I threw up, it was like projectile vomiting, right? And I could see it to this day. It went straight to the ceiling in the living room. And I was so drunk, and I'm watching it just fall. Macaroni and cheese. Oh, we have genteel drinkers here tonight. Okay, you didn't drink like that. Oh, and all I could think of was, man, I'm in trouble. I'm in so much trouble. And you know what? My dad came up and he slapped me around a little bit. And I'll never forget that because I was so drunk. And he says, "How dare you raise your fist to me?" And bam. And I'm like, dude, I did not raise my fist to you. But the next day, he worked for the city, and he brought over, like, these police, you know, he knew cops and my uncle, and everybody's talking to me, and I got such a hangover. I can remember sitting in bed, and I have never felt this bad. When they were talking about Stan was talking about that, it was like, you have sweaters on your tongue. Your tongue's wearing a little sweater, right? And they're all lecturing me, and I'm nodding, and I'm this and that, and in the back of my head, all I could think about was, man, I want to do that again. I can't wait till the next time I get a chance to drink because of the effect it had on me. I was overweight, chubby as a kid. And, man, I couldn't talk to girls. I couldn't dance. I had I don't know if you call it, whatever you want to call it, shy, backward. I did not have social skills. And that alcohol, man, gave me those skills, man. It just, poof. I was the silver-tongued devil. A couple of drinks. But, as you know, it doesn't work forever like that. I can tell you this much. If I felt that way the first time I drank alcohol, and I would have never stopped. I would have never stopped. Okay, I just want to, you know, get moving along here a little bit. Am I done yet? No. I went to rehab. I'm going to skip ahead, okay? In my 20s, I'll just say this. In my 20s, everybody's getting married and buying homes, and they're moving on with their lives. And I'm still just partying. It's still a big party to me, right? I found out I had sales skills. I could get these great jobs and do okay and make money. And I'd last about 8 or 9 months and I'd get fired, right? You know, I'd get fired. It's like when you're getting fired in sales where drinking is such a part of the job, right? And I can remember running out to my car, running back and forth to my car. And they're like, "What are you doing in your car?" Right? And they're like, "Oh, he's doing a little coke." But I was really stealing, right? And I would run to my car and dump this stuff and run back in. And I mention that because I was able to make some kind of amends to that place, right? And then that felt good, to make a little amends there. But, you know, I was developing a problem. I knew I had a problem. I knew I had a problem. I started, I was in a meeting recently and I heard like a 17-year-old kid say, "I'm a hope to die dope fiend," or something along those lines, right? And I thought to myself, there's no way that a kid 17 can be a dope fiend like that. And then I thought back. On my 18th birthday, I was a heroin addict. Okay, I started using at 17. On my 18th birthday, I was strung out. I was hooked. And believe me, this is like in the mid-70s. It just wasn't chic then. There was nothing cool about using heroin. There was nothing cool at all about that. I mean, you just didn't do that. You know, coke was always accepted, but not this. And I'm going into the ghettos of Detroit, and this is where I'm buying my drugs, and I'm living this life. Now, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about drugs here because I have to because it's a huge part of my story. But I knew I couldn't continue doing this. I just knew this wasn't the thing to do. So I would always switch back. You know, they talked about scotch to brandy. I started drinking again, right? And there was a period for a 10-year period where this was way before these pills they're talking about now. You know, it was a 10-year period from the late 70s where all I did was go to doctors, okay? We used to call that making doctors. And I would go to doctors to work them for pain medication and this kind of stuff. And, you know, I felt that I really wasn't doing too bad then because it was legal. I had Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And I was like, man, it was like a credit card, you know. Do not leave home without it. I got a call from them because I had ran up like $40,000 in medical bills one year with it. But the only reason I mention that is because I have no qualms about being able to ever take pain medication. Okay, I have no qualms about being able to take any type of pills like that, you know, like Valium or something like that. I just don't, because that's what I used to do to get high. You know, so I can't do that. You know, it's like short of open heart surgery, I can't take pain medication, okay? No can do. And that's okay. That's okay. I went to rehab. Well, welcome to all the people in rehab. I know you're in rehab, right? Because there's just not that many newcomers in San Clemente. But welcome, man. I'm so glad you... I'm so glad you guys are here, man. I am so glad you're here. Okay, Andrea and I were talking before, and she said, there it is. That's why you're speaking tonight. Look at all the new people. And that's why I get up here. I'm going to lay it out for you because of you guys. And something, you know, she spoke last week, right? And I was going to come, and I said, she's in the bathroom, and she says, you don't have to come and hear me speak because I'm not coming to see you next week. Hey, okay, that's cool. I'm good with that, you know, I'm good with that. And we were talking, and I asked her, I said, well, you know, it'd be kind of cool if you came tonight. She goes, well, I've heard you speak 100 times. I go, hey, you hear me speak every day. It's not about speaking, it's about the presence. Okay, she's got like thousands of friends. I don't. But, oh, I'm good, believe me, I'm good. But, no, so, and then she says, yeah. How does she put it? I told her I was going to use it tonight. She goes, I can come and you incessantly talk all the time anyway, so I might as well come. But you know what? It's like, I'm going to steal, this is someone else's line, but being with her is like being in a meeting 24 hours a day, okay? And you know what? I just want to honor her and mention her. I took a cake up here one time and thanked everybody in the room and didn't say a word to Andrea, so... I'm going to get that out of the way now. But we've been living together for a long time. I think we were like broke up for a year or so. I don't know. Nobody moved out, so. But, and you know, that's true. But you know what? I just want to mention my rehab, okay? When I went to rehab, oh, God, it was a great rehab. It was called Sacred Heart in Detroit. Great rehab based on Betty Ford, okay? It was all 12 steps, you know, 90 days, man. We're getting tight. We're hanging out. It's cool. We're liking it, you know. I'm reading the big book in the 12 and 12. I'm 31 years old, right? And what drove me in there at this point of my alcoholism was, well, you know, it was pills, okay? And I can remember thinking, all right, during this rehab, all right, I got a problem with these pills, there's no doubt. You know, these are the kind of pills you inject, okay? I got a problem with those. No doubt I got a problem with those. But do I have a problem with alcohol? Yeah, I did, but in the back of my head, maybe not. Can I smoke pot? Maybe I can. See, I had reservations then. And I can remember right before I was getting out, I was in a room like this. And there was a speaker, this girl was speaking, and I'll never forget this. She was a University of Michigan graduate. She was so funny and so real. And I can just remember sitting there going, and I was getting spiritual at the time, you know, I was like, God, you know, if I could have a girl like that, I could certainly get sober, you know? And, and I can remember that was my thought process at the time. And afterwards, you walk up and thank the speaker. And I thanked the speaker, and we talked a little bit, and she gave me her phone number, right? So the day I got out of rehab, I went straight to live with her. And and she got me a job. She did. I remember she sent me this questionnaire, what's your drug of choice? I'm like, beer. You know, and this is just such a part of my recovery, because I'll never forget this. I learned a lot about AA at the time. So I go with her, and she gets me a job. She's managing this waterfront hotel, I mean, this nice place. And I come into her office one day, and she's all slumped down behind her chair. And I'm like, hey, Sarah, are you okay? And she says, oh, yeah. So I said, what are you, what's that in your hand? She had pills in her hand. And I go, God, we were just taught that, not to take Valium. And I go, are you taking pills? And she goes, yeah. She goes, you want one? And I go, yeah. I said, man, the way I feel sober, I could use a Valium the size of a hockey puck, man. Oh, man, I was wound up tight. And I can remember, so it starts with the drinking. I go over to her pad one day. Well, actually, we weren't living together, but not yet. So I go to her pad, and there's so much smoke in this room, it looks like there's been a fire, right? And there's like 10 empty wine bottles all around the floor. So I see her passed out on the floor. And she doesn't look passed out, she looks dead. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is... I check her pulse, she's breathing, right? And what the smoke was, she'd smoked about 400 cigarettes, man. Looked like a bonfire in there. And there's all these empty wine bottles, and I check her pulse, she's okay. So I'm like going through her purse, and I find the Valiums in her money. I took her money in her Valiums, and I called 911. I got the hell out of there, you know. And I didn't look back, right? I didn't look back. And that was my first time with recovery. And, you know, the one thing they taught me, and I don't recommend that if you're in rehab, okay? I just don't. That's not the way to do it. And the one thing, when I was 31, I had a full-length leather jacket. I had a two-year-old car in the parking lot, okay? I was like nowhere near powerless. I was nowhere near my bottom when you think about it, when I think back on it. But in the rehab, I learned so many valuable lessons, right? They told me it was progressive, that I was going to get worse, that it would get worse. And as soon as I got out and started running again, I was always knew about AA, but I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed to go back because of this bad scene I'd caused, right? You know, and I just had these bad feelings, and I would always say, people bring it up. Every once in a while, people in my lifestyle, in my circle of friends, would disappear. And I'd be like, what happened to them? They went to AA and they got sober. And that, you know, that would happen. People would disappear out of your circle. And they were getting sober. You know, they were getting sober. And I can remember at the time, they told me it was progressive. And I didn't even know what that meant. But it was just like 1985, 86. It took me 17 years to get back to AA. That was 2002. And everything they said was going to happen to me, okay? All right, they said, dude, you're headed for prison. And I was like, no way am I ever going to prison, man. You know, I'm just like, just not going to. I'm a criminal, but I don't get caught, you know. I thought I was too cool for this shit. And they also said, you know, you're not going to be able to hold these good jobs like you're doing. And they were absolutely right, okay? And so for that 17-year period, I just went down and down and down. Okay, 1989, I came to California. And, you know, I didn't come out here. It was like a geographic here, okay? I wanted to get sober. I mean, I didn't want to keep doing drugs. I didn't even know what sober meant. I did not want to be in the situation I was in Detroit, okay? I left that town 4 hours before the cops were to come there. That's all been cleared up, you know. I mean, not that I did anything. Statute of limitations ran out on that. But I came to California in 89, and I thought it was going to get better. It got worse. It got so much worse, okay? It just got much worse. And the 90s were just, that's when I went to prison. I went to prison in 1995, and I can tell you this, it's not like it is on TV, okay? It's not like it is on TV, okay? Now, you might hear that thing in AA, act as if, okay? Now, I wasn't a hardcore convict. I was a drug addict. I was a hustler. I was a con man. But so you just act as if, okay? And I can remember I was just talking to Oscar about this. I was in Soledad 95. And I had hair down to here, man. I had long, long, flowing long hair. And this dude walks up to me, and across his forehead, he's got 5150 in block letters. And he's fucked, man. This dude is huge. He's big. And I'm telling you, he's got ink on every single inch of his body, man. I mean, down to his fingertips, he's tattooed. And I'm like, what's up, man? He goes, He goes, you're Indian, right? I says, well, you know, actually, dude, I'm Italian, but I got some native blood. My grandmother's half Native American. He says, you're Indian, brother. And there's a shake you do, an Indian shake that some people know, right? And do the shake, you know, and so this is what the bottom line is. When you're in prison, some guy with black letter tattoos on his forehead says, hey, dude, you're Indian? Well, hell yeah, I'm Indian. And that's the message there. But you know what? It was cool, though, you know. To use prison parlance, I told him, shit jumps off, I'm with the white car, all right? But anyway, you know, they made me a medicine bag, and I got close, and I got into that. I learned Indian songs that I know to this day. And at the same time, now, for over a seven-year period, okay, like I never did a lot of time, but I went back to prison four times, okay? This is the way the system was set up in California. At that point in time, they were more about incarceration instead of rehabilitation, okay? So I would give two dirty tests, and boom, I was on the chain. I was going to Chino. You know, I knew this. After a while, I know this. And this is the power of the disease. See, I had this girl at the time. I had a nice place in Orange, and she wasn't an alcoholic. She wasn't a drug addict. And, man, she was doing her best to prop me up. She wanted me to do good. She saw I would show her enough potential to keep it going, right, just so I could, like, have a car to drive all day and a place to live. And it was just, you know, God, it's just dark times, man. It was dark times then. And the power of the disease was knowing that if I gave another dirty test, I'm going to prison. There's no doubt I'm going to prison. And I couldn't stop. I could not stop, okay? I walked around 90% of the time with a PAL warrant, which is a parolee at large, because I just wouldn't show up, man, because why am I going to show up? I'm going back to prison, okay? And I can remember getting 12-stepped one time at this was in Delano. This is another penitentiary, right? I was in Delano. And this guy, they came in from AA, and they 12-stepped me, and they talked about the program and talked about the power of the program and talked about having he'd been at a convention, and there was like thousands of people saying the Lord's Prayer or the Serenity Prayer. And I can remember he planted a seed. He planted a seed, you know. I remember thinking about that. I thought, that's awesome, but you know what? I'm going to get high when I get out. that's just the way it was at that point. So, you know, this is what my life had degenerated into, okay? I was a middle-class kid. You know, no matter if my dad was an alcoholic or not, he put food on the table. They both worked. You know, I was an only child. Believe me, I lacked for nothing, okay? You know, I look back at it, and I had aunts, and I had everybody just loved me and took care of me and just did everything I wanted. And it's for whatever reason, it carried over. It was always like that with women, okay? They took care of me. And I can remember, you know, when this pampering, they were pampering, and when this pampering stopped, man, I saw it as abuse. Jesus, come on, what? Work? No. But anyway, you know, this is what drugs and alcohol did to me. You know, this is where I ended up. And, you know, when I got out that last time, I was like, did the same thing I always did. Ended up back in detox, walked out of the detox. And I remember having to take a bus all the way from Anaheim to, like, different parole agents, different offices. And I finally got a ride down to Dana Point. And that was where there's rehab, the state paid rehab. Okay, I went there, and I got out July 15th, 2002, and for the next till the 16th, I didn't get sober till the 16th of August. But when I went to this place, I was like, okay, man, I got to give this a chance. Okay, you know, when you talk about a bottom, you know, if I can put my, you know, a bottom is I'm sitting in a motel in Anaheim with three people living in a motel in Anaheim, and you know, I've got vodka in the refrigerator, and I've got to wake up. And I don't want to get out of bed, man. I don't want to get out of bed. I lay there and watch cartoons until I was so physically sick I couldn't stand it. Because the joy was gone, okay? I had good times with alcohol. I had good times with drugs. But I wrung every last bit of joy out of it. It was no fun, okay? You know, you get to this point where you can't get drunk. You can't get sober, okay? They call it the jumping off point in the big book. And that's where I was at. I mean, I switched every drug in my repertoire, okay? And I could not get that high anymore. So I threw in the towel. And I can remember going to, when I went to this place, the rehab part of it was cool, but I connected with AA right away. You know, I'd go to that club, that little club. I would come to this meeting. I would come to this meeting when I had 30 days, when Stan was the secretary. And I bring that up to him ad nauseum, because he used to bring in the best speakers. So I got to see Clancy. I got to see Mickey Bush. I got to see Treehouse Dave. You guys, if you don't know who those guys are, they're the best. And I was just like, wow, this is AA. I love this shit. This is how I feel. When I read the big book, this is how I felt, okay? The stuff it talked about, that's me, okay? Restless, irritable, discontent. I don't care what it mentions, what I took or what I didn't took. That was me in that big book. I identified with every single thing it talked about in there. And I would go to that little club. And I went to Sober Living, which I think is good. Go to rehab, Sober Living, do the whole bit. I would go to Sober Living. I was in Sober Living with Red. And I would go to the club, and I just love these meetings. It's not even open anymore, this little club in San Clemente. I would go to these meetings. Will was there on Sunday morning, and I would just be blown away. I love this shit. Greg was the secretary on Thursday night, and I always bring this up to him too, because you don't forget that stuff. At least I don't. When I'd walk out of those, when I got to AA, let me just clarify this. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you could put every bit of my belongings in a duffel bag, all right? I had nothing. I hadn't had a driver's license in 6-7 years. I had worked in 10. And I was busted, man. I was broke. I busted out. And I would go to these meetings. I would work. I got a job next to the old club. And I would go to the meetings, and I would walk home. And Greg used to give me a ride, right? Because, I couldn't ask anybody for a ride. Man, what if they said no? Shit, man, I would have just fallen apart, you know, because I was so raw when I was new. And Greg gave me a ride home up that hill. And I walked to work every day. And I can remember justifying this, because, man, I had like this huge, typical alcoholic ego, right? Why am I walking, you know? I'm just be driving me, you know. And I used to think, I'm so out of shape, man. I was in such bad shape when I got sober that I needed to do this walking, right? I was smoking like 1,000 cigarettes, you know, but I needed to walk and get back in shape. So I did a lot of walking. And I can tell you this real quick. I got a car. But about 90 days, I had a ton of shitload of tickets in California. I owed like $2,000 in tickets. But I had a Michigan license. So I got a little Toyota with my income tax check, and I was working, and I got this little Toyota, and I'm like going to work, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm like so proud of myself, you know, I'm doing it. And I get pulled over in Dana Point, and I give the cop my license, and I give him all my stuff. He goes, "What is this, a Michigan license?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "You don't have a California license?" I go, "Oh, no, I'm using that." He goes, "Where do you live?" I go, "That the rehab over there." And he says, "Step out of the car." And they said, "Are you on parole or probation?" Well, yeah, I'm on parole, but I'm 88 days sober, you know. Dude, I want a parade, you know. Shit, you're going to hassle me about this shit? And anyway, the bottom line is they confiscated my car. They took that car and they held it. I just paid $2,400 for that car. And they held it for 30 days. They have to automatic. And to get it back, I have to have let's put it this way. I never got that car back. I drove it for 10 days, man. I could have hired a limo to drive me around for cheaper than that. But, okay, when they took that car away, I can remember I was so effing mad, man. You know, I was like, you know, they won't let me back into society. You know, I'm outside the realms of society. I'm an outlaw. And you know what? That's all bullshit, you know. Nobody really cares, you know. And so I go to my little place, and I get this girl to drive me to the club for the meeting. And I go rushing in there, man, and I got my hand up to share, and I'm going to tell them. I'm going to say, "Hey, you don't know what just happened to me. I just got brutalized by the police. They just took my car away, and I didn't drink. And I got my hand up to share this, right? And this little old lady, and this is the craziest thing. Sharon was there that night. Sharon, everyone who knows Sharon, was talking to her about being her sponsor. I never saw that old lady again. This old lady raises her hand and talks about her son had just, she just got out of rehab. Her son had just got killed in a boating accident, right? And she tells this whole story about this tragedy, this horrible tragedy, and she's not going to drink today. And I just put my hand down, right? Because I said, okay, I get it. I get it. God, I get it. And you know what? That's a, what do you call it? A stepping stone, a turning point in my sobriety that day right there. And what I did was I started, I paid back my tickets. I paid back all those tickets, $100 a month. I'd get a couple hundred extra. Got my driver's license back, you know, continued to work. Discharged my number, a number I had for 7 years, okay? I had the same number for 7 damn years. That's a prison parole number. And I discharged that number, all within, but you know what? That was just residual stuff that came from being sober and doing the deal, okay? All that stuff comes back to you when you get sober and apply this program to your life. Everything came back to me. And you know, there was something else that I couldn't put a tag on, is the fact that I was happy. I was content. Okay. I had a measure of contentness. You know, Andrea likes to refer to me as a chronic malcontent. And there's something to that. But I can tell you this much. I don't want to get high. I don't want to drink. That's been removed. And, you know, and you know, they talk about the steps. If it was just about stopping drinking and stopping using, hey, man, we wouldn't even be here tonight, okay? We'd just stop. Boom, I'm going to stop. I'd stop every time I got locked up. Boom, I'd stop. You know, but the minute I got out, I'd resume again. There's more to it than that. I started working these steps. I got a sponsor. I started working these steps. And, you know, I always had a faith in God. I had a belief system, right? I like to say that I would get up every day, and I used to carry around a little St. Christopher's medal. This is my chip right now. And I'd run it around my fingers, and I would say, you know, God, please guide me and protect me today. Protect me from the forces of evil, God. And you know what? That was the police. That's how I thought. That's the prayers I said. You know, don't let me get busted today, God. I don't want to spend the night in Chino. And this is how I prayed. But, you know, this was different this time. I was just looking like, I like the big book talks about the great spirit of the universe, okay? I mean, I'm not allied. AA is not allied, and I'm certainly not with any religion sect or anything like that. And if I would have walked into AA and they started talking religion, man, I'd have turned around and walked out. But it's not about that. See, that was the beautiful thing about it. It's not about that. It was like you could have any God you wanted. And I dug that. I like that. And, you know, you talk about the third step, right? And Chuck C. said something very, very, very astute. This is one of the great old guys, AA. Chuck C. said, if we could do the third step perfect, there'd be no need for any other steps. Okay? And so, you know, that's something I work on every day. But the fourth step was something for me. I did it with Randy G, and we were in front of the club walking back and forth. And I read that to him. And man, it was like, just like lifted off my shoulders, you know, this stuff I've been carrying around forever. I had this intense resentment against my dad, or I thought I did, right? Oh, I wanted to add that. Okay, my dad, the alcoholic, my dad was a stone-cold alcoholic, okay? And my mom always said, we're going to leave him. We're going to get out of there, guy. We're going to leave him. Don't worry. And I was like, okay, Mom, we're going to leave. Well, anyway, she left and I stayed. And he got sick and sicker with alcoholism. And his liver swole up. He got cirrhosis. And his liver swole up like that big. And they had to do surgery. They had to remove a rib from him and put a tube into his side to drain the poison out of his stomach cavity because his liver was no longer functioning. So I watched this whole thing. I was 17. I watched this, man. And he became demented, dementia, and he started talking this crazy thing. It was like another language. And anyway, he died. He died of cirrhosis of the liver. And I can remember, he was 43 years old, okay? And I can remember thinking, man, he had a pretty good run, you know, he had a pretty good run. But he was only 43. And see, that's what alcoholism, hardcore alcoholism. This guy worked every day of his life.
He wasn't a skid row bum. He worked. He did the whole nine yards. And you know what? I had this deep resentment, or at least I thought I did. But, you know, this is so hokey, but that damn movie, Field of Dreams, if for a guy, that movie's got special meaning, all right? And I started crying. Do you know the movie? I'm going to go into it. It's about a dad playing catch with his ghostly father. And I started crying when I was watching that. And I'm talking about bawling. And it was uncontrollable. And this girl I'm with at the time says, "You okay?" And I go, "Yeah, I am okay. I actually am." I didn't realize for 10 years that I had forgiven my dad at that moment. I forgave my dad. Now my mom's the one I had the resentment against. Yeah. And I dealt with that. And, you know, just quickly, I'm almost out of time here. With my mom, anyway, you know, I worked all 12 steps and I continue to. I just can't stress the importance of the steps, okay? The meetings are great and they're a beautiful thing, man. And it's one alcoholic and talking to another. But you work those steps and it relieves that stuff inside you. It relieves that stuff inside of you. But, my mom, okay? Now, when my mom got sick with cancer, it's been 2 or 3 years now, and Marcia and Jack, my mom talked to Marcia, and Marcia said she was going to look out for me. And that was like the coolest thing ever, right? See, Marcia used to be like my older sister, but I think I'm like an older brother now. Our ages, you know, are pretty close, but I think she's, yeah, and I just appreciated that. But she got the cancer. I flew back to Michigan, stage 4, and man, there ain't no stage 5. I flew back and I spent this time with her, and I can remember my family saying, "Hey, we're going to send you a plane ticket, guys." No, you don't have to send me a plane ticket. I'll buy my own. And, you know, they've taken care of me my whole life, and this was at a point I could take care of myself. I was there. I went back to Michigan. I sat with her. And, you know, I spent that time with her until she passed. You know, and I can remember being in the kitchen where I was leaning on the counter. Well, I was leaning on the counter, and I saw these pills. And I'm like, they're Oxycontin, right? And my aunt says, "Guy, do you want me to get rid of those?" I go, "Auntie, if I wanted them, you could bury them in the backyard and I'd find them." All right? But it was gone, okay? The obsession was gone, okay? I used to go there specifically to raid their medicine cabinet, right? And, I mean, not for that, but anyway, I was able to be there for her, and that's what AA has done for me, okay? And in her last day, she says to me, "Honey, don't go see your old friends." And I go, "I'm not gonna, Mom. Don't worry, I'm not gonna." And you know what? Through Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to do that and stay sober. And you know what? Today, it's just a daily thing. It's a daily thing. So, you know, I hope that if you guys are new, all you new people, hang out, stick around. Okay, like Greg likes to say, stick around for 90 days. And if you're not happy, we'll gladly refund your misery. Okay? And I want to thank Fred real quick, too. I did that one day. You can do that, the whole steps in one day with Fred. It's amazing. It's an amazing thing. So thank you all. Thank you all for listening to us.